Microphone check. 1, 2. The microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2. The microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They knows I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my de-scrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Noam. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS Tazaruk. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
And here we are on the 4th of March. Tell me, Paul, what do you think the chances are that the Carlyle Group is involved in the Dubai Ports World thing? And that's the real reason that Bush and friends are so excited about it.
Let's see, who was writing about that? Not a favorite of yours, Cunson was writing.
Most remarkable person writing about it is this fellow Jerome Corsi, who was the co-author of the Swift Boat book about Kerry.
Ah.
And that is, but I mean, this is remarkable because the attack on the Bush people, on the Dubai Ports thing, is coming from, well, you might say
the
right.
Place.
But I mean, the people who were after Kerry in the last election are now after Bush for the same, you know, well, for, in this case, cronyism and, you know, out and out peculation. The Carlyle Group, John Snow, the Treasury Secretary, was involved with a group that the Carlyle Group had a position, was chairman, was...
CSX, you're talking about?
CSX, exactly.
Was bought by the British firm that ran the ports. And they were going to be bought by the one that's the, well. They have been bought.
That's right.
Know? It actually
that's
has
right.
gone ahead.
It happened. So. It's happened. And but the point is, the Carlyle Group had a big stake or took a big stake in this CSX company that John Snow was head of before he became Treasury Secretary. Well, the Carlyle Group is essentially the financial incarnation of the Bush family and friends. A number of people on various points of the spectrum have wondered why Bush. Made a call from Air Force One when the criticisms of the Dubai Port World deal began, defending with such heat this deal.
Well, now, he invited his usual followers up. He usually takes his sleep while he's on the plane.
But the point is that he jumped into this
thing and
made a point out of it right away. I've resisted, as you know, in our discussions over time, the notion that the Bush administration is doing things just for reasons that are personal and financial. And I'm not saying they're doing it just for those reasons here. I mean, the Bush policies have been consistent with policies of American governments for a long time. But there's growing evidence that there is an element of personal enrichment involved in this. Well, that's quite striking, quite surprising.
Snow definitely had the CSX holding and will.
Well, he was chairman of CSX,
right.
Yeah.
And so I pointed that out last week. One thing that we didn't point out last week that I wanted to get to, which is, you know, maybe there is some vulgar capitalism and vulgar Marxism going on here, but and some real blatant cronyism going on. But on the other hand, there's also this analysis that how many dollars are floating around the rest of the world, particularly petrodollars, mm-hmm. and the idea that if you can't, you know, if these people can't cash them in and buy assets, what good are they? And will Arabs, will Chinese, they stop buying the dollar as a economy of our currency of holding sort of thing? And I think that's part of their calculation.
I think
actually,
there's the old story here, you know, that if you owe the bank $5,000 and can't pay, you're in trouble. If you owe the bank $5 million and can't pay, they're in trouble.
Yeah.
And this
debtor's
is a case.
Cartel, as
yeah,
you should call. Yeah.
This is a case. I think that the Chinese situation right now, or indeed the Japan as well, the Asian economies who have so many dollars, they don't dare produce a major decline in the dollar because they hold so many of them. And the policy of the Bush administration has been, in fact, or until fairly recently, to draw the dollar down a bit to try to deal with the great trade deficits. At the moment, that hasn't worked. I mean, people continue to want the dollar, so the dollar keeps bouncing back up, and the Bush administration says we're not doing anything about it as they are quietly suppressing it. And they made the equivalent of a run on the dollar last year, but it didn't last long.
They're countervailing forces, it seems. But there's this persistent thing out in on the internet, other places, about the idea that one of Hussein's offenses prior to the invasion was he was going to go to Euros, and now there's the business about the Iranian Euro-based oil bourse and that kind of thing. I talked to a couple of people about it, and they say that the real critical thing is the countries around the world have to back their own currency up by holding dollars, and that is actually a huge amount of money. And if that were ever to shift over to euros in a big way, that would actually
that'd be an earthquake,
destabilize the dollar. You know, they want it to get weaker, but they don't want it to collapse. And the idea that if they can't, you know, this oil deal earlier with the Chinese wanting to buy holdings, which were actually nowhere near us, they were basically around Burma, if I recall. The oil assets that they were actually going after were more in their area than over here. But, you know, everything is the U.S.'s area when it comes to oil.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think what really worries the U.S. is actually less the financial stuff, because, as you say, the possibility of sort of redoing the world oil market in euros, which has been suggested both in regard to Iraq and Iran, really doesn't, you know, at least I'm told the same thing you are by people who look at this more closely, that that's really not quite possible. But one thing that is possible is, as a direct result of American policy, is sort of a loose alliance of the Shiite areas of the Middle East, which also happen to be the major oil producing areas, that is Iran, part of Iraq, and part of Saudi Arabia. The Shiite areas are the areas that control the oil. And the U.S. is very much concerned when Iran starts talking about doing energy deals, oil deals with the East, with China, with Russia, even with India.
Yeah,
I mean,
Bush,
it's part
Bush
of
just
the,
said today, he was asked about this pipeline going to India, and he said, "Well, we don't have any problem with that."
Well, of course he doesn't. But Bush is just back from making a very interesting deal with the Indian government about nuclear energy and so forth. Still may run into some serious Dubai ports trouble here in the U.S. It's hard to believe that one of the reasons for the concerns with India right now is to make sure that traditional alliance between Iran and India is not renewed, and renewed on the basis of transfer of energy. So you know, it's not an accident that Bush is in South Asia right now.
Yeah. There's so much to be said about that. I haven't. I even looked to the BBC, and they don't have anything very concrete about what this deal really is, what the specifics are. That 14 of the 26 reactors are going to be reclassified as civilian. They'll be subject to inspection. And how they got Baraday up on this, I really don't understand, because this does undermine NPT.
Of course it
Apparently
does.
It's not against the letter of NPT, but it's certainly against the spirit of NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
It's a major embarrassment, too, when a major part of the U.S. Propaganda right now is to say, oh, look at those Iranians, they're doing things with nuclear energy. Let's go next door, talk to the Indians, let them do things with nuclear energy, and as you say, they're not even signatories to the treaty, which everyone admits Iran has been observing. So, I mean, it's the contradictions in the American policy.
Well, not everyone admits that. The constant thing
is the world at large admits that. I mean, the American government does admit it. But the contradiction between India and Iran on this point, the contradiction in the American policy, I think, is what's visible to the world.
The IEA did just release in the last couple of days, maybe this is on the other hand for Baraday, that there's no evidence that Iran is actually going towards weaponizing
And yet you and I both heard an NPR this morning saying, well, of course, Iran breaks international law when it comes to, this was someone who was being interviewed on NPR, but it was unrebutted. The point just lay there, that is, the American propaganda point, which certainly is not proven in any way at all that Iran is breaking international law in regard to nuclear energy.
Well, I don't know. I need to go back and check it, but it seems to me that there were these unauthorized purchases, undeclared purchases through the AQCON, because at one point they were accused of having already started doing some high-level enrichment, and they found out that it was actually just a residue that was on the material they got from Pakistan. And there was also an instance of some documents that were supposedly found in one of the inspections that had to do with weaponizing. And they were apparently also of Pakistani origin and probably just came along with the package, in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, but the American government's position has been, we have another rogue state here in Iran that is developing nuclear weapons. Well, I mean, there's another argument. You and I have had it, you and I have mentioned it before, that probably any Iranian government in the current situation would be remiss if it were not looking seriously at making nuclear weapons. But in fact, Iran says that it is indeed observing the treaty, that the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it signed, and it certainly has not been shown that it isn't. It has been shown that one major power is not observing that treaty, and the last international conference on the treaty broke down because that was true. And that, of course, is the United States. As you've pointed out several times before, the U.S. has made no move whatsoever to live up to its obligations under that treaty.
It's worse than that. We've got line items and repetitive, I forget what the euphemism is for now, but they're starting on a new series of nuclear weaponry.
Which is directly contrary to the undertakings that the U.S. put forward at the time of the promulgation of that treaty.
Well, I remember when goes back about a month ago, when the IEA was deliberating on it, and the big deal was made out of Egypt getting this provision that includes disarmament in the area, and this was indirectly affecting Israel, which we haven't mentioned yet, which is obviously the biggest double standard in the room.
Exactly.
But nothing's been made of it. You know, it was like I thought it would have an impact. You know, but it hasn't. And I guess it's what John Bolton says. This is just stuff that's written down. You know, doesn't mean anything.
I don't pay much. A scrap of paper.
Don't pay attention much to it. Yeah. He you know, and we also comment on how they finessed this issue coming to the Security Council after in March, so that Argentina is now head of president of the Security Council, so Bolton didn't get to work his will on it. Now, I don't know if that was really what they wanted to do, whether they thought the time had ripened or what.
But
was apparently what the plan was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're listening to News from Neptune, Carl Estabrook, and Paul News.
Wrap into poetry here for your next show?
No, I'm running into the middle of the day already. Yes, you're listening to News from Neptune, Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth talking about the news of the week and its coverage by the media.
Since you invoked your literary show, this thing going on about My Name is Rachel Corrie, I think, should have a
comment. That's what we were leading. This is a very important point. Yeah.
What did I see Alan Rickman in? I have a very good impression of him. Oh, I have no idea what it
was. Seen him in all sorts of things, from Harry Potter to Galaxy Quest.
Was he in Ulysses? I don't remember.
I think he may have been, now that you mention. I have to pull up IMDb here and have a look. But Alan Rickman is a brilliant British actor. I like him very much. One of his most interesting movies is Truly Madly Deeply, which is, I think...
That was just last year.
Years ago with Juliet Stevenson, which I think is an amazing flick. And, you know, he's very interesting. He was in New York last year with a revival of the Noel Coward... couples, you know. In any case.
Well, since you're going to lead with that, we'll only spend a little time on it.
But we're mentioning, Alan Rickman. Alan Rickman was the director, or the co-director, of a play that won the best won the award for the best new play from the Theatre Goers Guild in London last year. It's called My Name is Rachel Corrie. And, of course, it's about the American woman who was killed by a caterpillar tanker.
Well, it's a dramatization of her letters, basically.
A caterpillar.
So it's from her first hand.
A caterpillar bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier. And the play was very well received in London, and they were planning a New York production of it, which is now not going to happen.
These aren't typical caterpillar bulldozers.
No, indeed.
They have a back gunner. They have their two-person... they're sort of a tank with a with earth moving potentialities.
Yeah, exactly. And the play has been canceled in New York because of the fear of offending sensibilities. Rickman, to his credit, has called it what it is. It's censorship. The play is being censored in New York. So as a result, other people around the country, including our town, are looking at the possibilities of putting this on.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I was thinking we should write this guy, Jeff Skoll, who got money from eBay and has this outfit, Participant Productions. He's apparently the money behind Good Night and Good Luck, North Country, Syriana, and an upcoming movie called Fast Food. And Participants' films have received 11 nominations for the Academies. That's tomorrow, isn't it? How about that?
Yep.
So I thought we should write him and say, why don't you bring this to the big screen and see how much distribution it could get.
As you point out, the play is made up of letters and emails and so forth by Rachel Corrie, and quite a rounded portrait apparently, and a sample of sort of what was going on in her brief life. I don't know how cinematic it is or how cinematic it could be made. It is definitely a spoken art, and but certainly would be an excellent idea.
Well, the dramatic scene of her being run over by a bulldozer could be...
The politics of the matter are going to be very much in the Oscar celebration tomorrow because of this film Paradise Now. There's been attempts to try to get this film withdrawn as a candidate for Best Foreign Film in the Oscars because it's a film about the trials of two young men in Palestine who are considering becoming suicide bombers. And the film is very political, as is the director, who is an Israeli-born Arab. There has been a great deal of controversy about it and a tremendous attempt by... quote, friends of Israel, close quote, to make sure that this film does not get any publicity, any honors, or any discussion.
Yeah, they're not even wanting to have it be said to be from Palestine.
Exactly. You know, yes, because Palestine doesn't exist, they say. I wonder whose fault that is.
Yeah. The territories are some territories as, as the
argument. Day territory,
yeah,
as you say.
This goes back to the discourse about what it really meant to say they should withdraw from the territories. In French, it's unambiguous that it's the territories, les territoires, as opposed to in English where the territories can be. Some of the territories are, you know, all of the territories.
Well, I was talking here particularly about Resolution 242, which in 1967 said that that Israel was to withdraw on the fundamental international principle that territory is not to be gained by war. Wonderful discussion between Norman Finkelstein and Shlomo Ben-Ami, that you can find on the Democracy Now! Website. It runs more than an hour, and they cut it down and broadcast it on Democracy Now!, but an absolutely brilliant laying out of the situation, a summary of the situation by two interesting folks, one who used to be foreign minister under the Barak government in Israel, and the other an American scholar who has published a number of amazing books, but his most recent book called Beyond Chutzpah about the, quote, new anti-Semitism, close quote.
Yeah, in Chicago now at DePaul, last I heard, unless they're trying to oust him from there.
It's a brilliant... I mean, if I... Right now, if somebody said, what's going on in Israel and Palestine, how do I understand it? This would be the first thing I'd send them to, Paul.
Well,
I'd say, go listen
to
this.
No, it's not a primer, I don't think.
I think it is. Well, it's a primer in the best sense of the word, in that it covers the matter accurately and in detail, in short compass, and without talking down. So, I mean, it does not assume that one knows a great deal about it. Finkelstein particularly is very careful about that. And in the discussion between the two men, there is a remarkable presentation of the issue of the situation and of the issues, or so it seems to me.
I think we should get back to the recent trip of the Prez a little bit. I like to call Musharraf General Perv, along the lines of Harry Shearer. The President Musharraf is really not...
Musharraf, as he's being called, apparently, in the Middle East.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, I heard that. Yeah.
Well, calling him president is a little...
Yeah. hey, we're spreading democracy, Paul.
Yeah.
Come on.
This cooster, that cooster, you know. Right. He's democratic enough for us, apparently. Of course, if the Egyptian elections were, if you had to be nominated by elected officials, was enough to be a democratic, I guess the standard isn't very high. And, you know, Bush can't have the standards very high since 2000 election was...
Remember our people in Haiti, they wanted to run a man against the government that we had put up in Haiti, and the government said, well, he's welcome to run, but he has to register in person. The problem was he couldn't register in person because the government had thrown him into jail.
Without charge. Well, they developed a charge eventually.
That's right. But, I mean, you know, it's a great catch, that catch 22. You know, I think something interesting is happening in this this particular trip, I mean, sort of as a background to this trip, there has been a rhetorical change in the Bush administration in the last couple of weeks from the global war on terror, the global war on terrorism, to, in Rumsfeld's formulation, the global extremist Islamic empire, the war against the global extremist Islamic empire. The global empire, that's what we're fighting now, and it's an Islamic empire. Bush in Pakistan, with General Musharraf standing uncomfortably next to him as the president of that country, as you say, says the enemy, once again, is radical Islam. In other words, there's been a move in the Bush administration, Paul, to religionize the war and to make Islam the opposition. I mean, this is very dangerous, but I mean, it's a result of, it seems to me, the Bush administration being pressed ever more in a corner. The poll results they've been reading are terrible. 2/3 of Americans think we never should have gone into this war in Iraq. 72% of the soldiers in Iraq want to come home, want to be out within the year. Even though, and I think this is an even more amazing number, even 85%, Paul, of the U.S. soldiers in Iraq think they are there in a retaliation for Saddam's role in 9/11.
Amazing.
Do you bloody believe that?
That's astonishing.
I mean, there is the triumph of the Bush administration propaganda as it was, but that triumph is breaking down. That propaganda is breaking down, and that's why I think we're seeing this, this really racist shift to the notion that what we're fighting against here is the Legion of Israel. This is General Boykin writ large.
Boykin's was right on the tip of my tongue.
Exactly.
I was ready to remind people that the guy that went around lecturing with his military uniform on to various right-wing religious groups that talking about how his God was bigger than theirs and that's why we'd win, never got reprimanded. In fact, they just got a desk job.
But they did
special forces.
But they they basically told him quietly to shut up. You know, they didn't embrace this at all. They are embracing it now. That's the rhetorical change.
Well, but they never, even at that time, they never really
because it was always an element of the propaganda. But it's now the predominant element. I mean, this is an amazing. Rumsfeld gave a speech this week in Independence, Missouri. Harry Truman Library about the Cold War. And he said, he admitted sort of what we've been saying all along, that after the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. needed a replacement for its bête noire, for the international communist conspiracy. The U.S. faced an enemies gap, as Colin Powell said 15 years ago. And what they replaced it with, explicitly, I mean, it's shameless, is the global Islamic empire. That's what we're fighting. And it's everywhere. Even in the credit card bills of this family. Did you hear about the credit card story? The family that was denounced to Homeland Security and Homeland investigated by Homeland Security because they paid off their credit card bill. They owed
that one's good
to
me.
They grow the credit card. Well, it's an interesting story. They owed a credit card company $6,000, and a retired couple who had moved from Texas to Rhode Island, actually to Massachusetts. And when they paid off the credit card company said, well, you know, we're holding your payment. We're not crediting it to you and so forth. And you've been reported to Homeland Security because they have to know about these major changes in people's finances. And this, the two of them, I mean, they spent enough time to get that explanation eventually, and it seems to be the case. This is published in the Boston papers this week, and an astonishing. So, I mean, it may simply suggest the further ineptitude of Homeland. We had other better reasons to believe in the ineptitude of Homeland Security this week, and the rumor is, of course, that Mr. Chertoff is going to be looking for work pretty soon. So.
Oh well, yeah. He can get reappointed to being a judge.
He can go back to being a judge. Sure, yeah. They need judges. Hell, they've got all those torture cases they have to approve.
What I find curious is this: the top of the fold on the News Gazette today is U.S. releases detainee names.
Releases. What a way to put it.
Yeah, it was a FOIA suit, and it wasn't a release.
Freedom
of
information, right?
It doesn't include everybody. I mean, no. I think it's about 2/3 of the people are mentioned.
Well, it includes.
But you have to go through and find
5,000 pages of transcripts of these military tribunals, if you work your way through that, and apparently AP reporters are doing that this weekend, you can come up with some of these names. But yes, the Associated Press sued the government under the Freedom of Information Act to get this sort of information at the, you know, and it's important, it's worthwhile, but there's been just a cascade of cases this week in which the U.S. government is saying, by the way, we're not bound by the McCain torture amendment, mm-hmm. thanks to the Graham Levin amendment. We can use evidence in the Guantanamo tribunals that's gained by torture, and people who have been tortured have no access to the American courts in spite of the McCain amendment because of what Lindsey Graham and his Democratic friends put into the same bill. I mean, a whole series of cases have appeared this week, counts of torture. Newsweek is carrying a record of torture of one detainee at Guantanamo. Several of these other cases have occurred in U.S. courts and in the Guantanamo tribunals, all of which the government, the Bush administration, is saying we're not bound by the anti-torture amendment and we can use evidence obtained that way.
Well, an interesting case in Chicago, and I'm wondering whether there's going to be any demonstration around this case. There's going to be an argument made about using results of Israeli torture. This guy that supposedly confessed to being knowingly complicit with, I don't know if it was Hamas or one of the other groups, but there's going to be apparently a fairly lengthy argument about whether this testimony that he, or this confession that he signed in Israel is going to be allowed to be presented. It seems to me that would be a good place for some political propaganda in the best sense of the word, some agitprop, maybe even some theater. I remember the best theater that I saw about this or heard about the whole torture issue was when John Yoo, the professor of torture,
yeah.
he's apparently, his hands are on a number of the documents have to do with sort of Bush's and any president's imperial authority. Some people came in dressed up as torture detainees and people on leashes and stuff into his law school classroom on Berkeley campus, where
right.
he is professor of law, and told him that he should take a hold of this the people that are the detainees that he rationalized and the torturees that he wrote the case for. He's quite outspoken. He's defending himself. He was doing a Heritage Foundation C-SPAN televised thing not so very long ago. So,
yeah, he's been all over C-SPAN talking about his views on torture and the unitary executive.
Right.
I'm just stunned, Paul, by that statistic. The polls that say 85% of soldiers in America in Iraq think that they're there in order to retaliate for Saddam's role in 9/11.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is how little coverage that Zoghbi poll has gotten.
Too.
I wonder if there's been any mention in the local rag. I don't know if the Gazette has covered the fact that 72% of soldiers I don't know how do you conduct a poll like that, but they got a lot of responses from soldiers saying, you know, we should get out of here.
Absolutely.
Which reminds me again of Cheney going over there and, you know, ducking a question from a soldier who said, I don't see it getting better here, and Cheney saying, don't believe everything you read in the paper, to somebody that was on the ground and knows what's going on.
Yeah, did you see what Cheney said this week? He cautioned people against getting into too much debt. He said, folks have to, I said, debt is not a good thing, you know. Now, this is the man who has presided over the most amazing turnaround in American finances, I mean, from the surplus of the Clinton
years
to the deficit now.
He's also the guy that said that the debt doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's just the Reagan years prove that, he said. And he's also, he certainly has handled it in his own case. I mean, thanks to Halliburton and whatnot, you know, he doesn't have to worry too much about debt, I suppose. But he's advising other people. I guess that means we all should get retainers from Halliburton in order to avoid debt. That would help me, I'm sure.
In just another Halliburton note, did you read anything about this contract they got for about $333 million to build detention centers around the United States?
Yeah,
I don't think this is because they're planning on closing Gitmo and moving off the island of Cuba.
They are planning to close Gitmo and move off the island of Cuba, but they're taking those people to Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan.
Or a new place in Morocco.
Exactly.
Well, by getting off the island, I meant getting off entirely. The lease ran out some time ago.
Oh, I think they intend to hold on to it. The Lewist argument is precisely, it repeats the arguments that led the Bush administration to open the prison camp in Guantanamo in the first place. Their original argument was by putting the camp there, it was under the control of the executives and the courts couldn't touch it because it wasn't on American soil. Therefore, American law couldn't be enforced by the courts there. Well, they now are saying essentially that the Graham-Levin amendment allows them to act that way. In fact, that's what the amendment reestablished for the American government. So in that sense, it's, you know, this gulag of offshore prisons, and offshore means, as you point out, from Morocco to Afghanistan and around and on, probably Romania and Poland too, has been it's been a godsend to the Bush government. They've avoided they didn't have to destroy the Bill of Rights entirely. They could just say it only works at home.
Well, I think after or before Condi went to her East European tour, they realized that having some of the detainees in a former Soviet jail in Romania was not the best, you know, PR. So I think they might have pulled them out, and who knows where in the world they are.
Yeah, the Poles continue to equivocate about what their arrangement is to the European Commission. The Romanians apparently have told the European Commission, no, we haven't got anybody anymore, so I think you may be right about that. But the Poles say, oh, well, gee, we have to check. We're not sure. So it's it's not a laughing matter, because what the U.S. is doing, this administration has probably done more to destroy the reputation of the United States around the world. I mean, since Tocqueville, the rest of the world has sort of smiled at American pretenses on democracy and the principles that we were supposedly based upon, because there was such a gap between those principles, excellent as they were, and the practice of Americans. But the practice of the Bush administration has driven that into such a hole that it's not clear that that reputation can ever be regained, and that's true around the world.
Don't have Simon to kick around today, but there was a rather spacey essay piece by Susan Stanberg today.
On NPR this morning?
On something about being able, Americans need to, can't let go, and we can't let go of notions like we're, supposed to be dedicated to democracy, but it wasn't in the sense that you or I would say it. It was a very strange point of view. It presumed that, you know, that indeed was what Iraq was about.
Yeah.
Which wasn't even, the memory hole is so fast and deep that you know, we have to keep reminding people that, well, nothing was said about that at the time, of course.
That's very true. But there were still things in the news this week that I loved. I mean, you know, Duke Cunningham going to jail for 8 years and so, and, you know, that warms the cockles of your heart in the sense that, you know, some of the graft and corruption in the House is punished, and you know, of course, this is the tip of the iceberg, and there's plenty more, but at least some people seem to be worried about that.
The Senate couldn't agree on having any kind of independent commission on looking at things, looking at donations and quid pro quos, et cetera.
So. And that was the thing that prompted the fight between McCain and our junior senator a couple of weeks ago, when McCain said our junior senator was being shifty on the matter. So there are certainly stories to be told here.
The Patriot Act, 11 votes.
The thing I liked about the Cunningham's scandal is that as it ramifies, in other words, as the question of bribery and corruption. One of the people who's turned up this week, once again, truth is stranger in fiction, is Dusty Fogo. Are you down with Dusty Fogo?
Got me.
Dusty Fogo
is the number three man
in the CIA. And it suggested that Dusty had his hand in the till of the defense contractors.
Not his real name, apparently.
No, well, his given name is Kyle, apparently. But he's no, yeah. The name is perfect.
He has a bank account under that name, though.
Who would dare write a novel in which the CIA chief is called Dusty Fogo? But that is the case in the Bush administration, and Dusty has his hand in the cookie jar, apparently, according to the Inspector General of the CIA, who is prompted to this by the fallout from the number of people, this man Wade particularly, who bribed Duke Cunningham. And apparently some of Wade's money found its way to Langley, Virginia, and to the executive director, I believe that's his title, of the CIA, Dusty Fogo. Well, you know, that's just too good. I mean, I want to follow the Dusty Fogo story.
We always come back to these looters and killers, and you know, the stories, you know, I don't know if Corp Watch has an index on this kind of thing, but, you know, Richard Pearl was involved in the Boeing lease scandal, for mm-hmm. God's sake. I mean, it's so thick and fast. And we started the show by suggesting that Dubai might be Carlisle connected.
Exactly.
I mean, it's amazing.
This is an interesting point. Noam Chomsky, in whose honor this show is named, made the point years ago that there is a sense in which bribery and personal corruption is an Achilles heel for oppressive governments. Chomsky points out the Nazis ran a fairly clean operation as far as corruption is concerned. They didn't steal a lot. It wasn't bribery and so forth. They stole the whole country. They stole the soul, perhaps, of Germany. That's pretty high level of peculation. But his point is that they weren't corrupt on this level. He says because corruption on this level actually tends to destroy an oppressive regime. It'll be interesting to see if that turns out to be true for the Bush administration.
Well, you think it'd be true already, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would, wouldn't you? Yeah, they've given enough reason for it. And while the numbers that the rest of us deal with were set out in black and white in the Wall Street Journal this week, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, that doesn't surprise you. But some of the particulars were interesting. For example, the notion that younger householders, younger families, people under 45, have lost ground in the wealth sweepstakes. Their wealth has declined under the Bush administration. Now, you know, this is the sort of thing that, of course, is noticed by the people who watch these polls in the Bush administration, and it's known by the people on the ground. It's sort of like, you know, the secret bombing of Cambodia. The people who are underneath it understood it perfectly well. In the economy, the people whose lifestyles are being confiscated by this division of the society into rich and poor that the Bush people are presiding over ever more avidly, they know what's going on. But it doesn't really sort of find its way to the top of the discussion. The discussion is carefully controlled in this matter. And another example in which the bulk of the American population is substantially to the left of either of the political parties. Because they know what's going on.
Yeah, I think it drives a number of that portion to this new prosperity gospel, hyper-Calvinism, that's so bizarre. Right. It was even on on WEFT last Sunday morning.
That's
actually
a symptom, not the disease.
Yeah,
though,
well, but
say?
I mean, yeah. When you don't have real politics, you get exactly. It gets displaced into other avenues.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Mm. But in the meantime, I mean, people are not fools, Paul, and even, you know, if these vast propaganda campaigns have remarkable effects, such as the attitudes of soldiers in Iraq, we do now have 2/3 of Americans saying the war is not worth it, we shouldn't be involved of, that Cheney's approval rating, that Bush's approval rating is in the lower 30s and Cheney's is 18%. I love that.
Well, there's one poll that shows that Cheney was higher than Bush this week for a glimmer. I guess it was the sympathy vote.
Kepler, they were afraid he'd shoot him.
Yeah. And go out drinking with him and with a gun in his hand.
That's right.
The Capitol Hill Blue has this, and people are saying, why are you bothering with that? There's so much going on, but it just bothers me that, you know, that you know, it goes away without any it was the Capitol Hill Blue thing about Cheney's drunken shooting, right. Has one White House aide, obviously he wasn't named, saying it was a South Texas hunt. Of course there was drinking going on.
And you're quoting Thompson, who runs that Capitol Hill Blue sheet, is serious, and he's been in Washington for a long time. He knows people, and he claims to be quoting the Secret Service report of the incident, which said that Cheney was inebriated.
And the blood test for the guy that was shot was confiscated. Spirited away.
Exactly, confiscated by the Secret Service.
Spirited away might be the right unintended pun there. Anyway,
it's already spirited. Yeah.
I guess we should treat that, and we'll see whether it comes up under the Oscars tomorrow night.
Mm.
With what's his name of the Daily Show being
John
on.
Stewart.
I don't have cable,
Stewart,
so I don't watch it. But our Governor Blago seems to have some bad people working for him. He was on, and he didn't know he was on a comedy show.
A remarkable number of them don't, apparently.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people are catching on now because they've made people look like such fools, beginning with, or at the top of the list.
You think
you'd
have somebody that would research it that would know. Maybe they were having a joke on him, too.
Well, he's got a further problem with this
Nation of Insults,
this hate crimes panel or whatever it is, and the appointment of a representative from the Nation of Islam, and that, you know, he's stuck in, he can't back in, he can't back out, he can't go further into the problem. I mean, it's a serious difficulty for the governor.
The only thing he has going for him is the ineptness of the Republicans, and our local fair-haired Governor Edgar is going to bat for Topeka. These hotels that she had built and then sold for like a nickel on the dollar at the state expense to cronies should come up at some point. So I don't know whether you can.
And it
Renaissance Hilton in Springfield is one of them, I guess.
Underneath the severely deficient personalities of Illinois politicians, there has been this last year an interesting move towards health insurance for all members of the state. That's winding around amidst the other politics of the matter. And in any sort of well-run political situation, that would be an issue. How do these candidates feel about this? What are they going to do about it? And when is Illinois going to have a system that treats people on the basis of how sick they are, not on how wealthy they are?
Yeah, and, I went to this public hearing on the healthcare task force. You can Google adequate healthcare task force Illinois, and I'm sure you'll come up with it. I one of the first things I said was I hope we eventually or pretty soon go beyond adequate. But
that's a place to start.
Quentin Young and James Duff at the Campaign for Better Healthcare is doing good work on that too. There's a lot of foment for this, and it's more needed than ever. The studies show how many people are underserved and how many Medicaid patients are not even able to get service in this county because they get rejected by the major hospitals now.
It's a shameful situation, and this is what our politicians should be talking about, not.
While Bush is talking about market solutions, he's also putting money into these community health care clinics, a number of which are run by faith-based. So, rather than having a system that's fair and equitable to all, we have this patchwork. And then the medical savings accounts, too, which is another lame excuse for tax relief, quote-unquote, for the wealthy.
Well, see, if we had an opposition party poll, they'd be pointing that out and putting forward programs that would solve this problem. But we don't, and so they aren't.
It's amazing that Blagojevich, in both of his addresses, the State of the State and the budget address, hollers out that he believes health care is a right.
Okay, but, let's do something about it.
That's where the rubber meets the road, and not just subsidize people to pay the insurance companies.
Exactly. That's the discussion we should be having, and what should be pointed out. But how many people are talking about that in terms of what Blagojevich is saying?
Well, there are these community meetings happening around, you know, but it's under the radar because the media doesn't cover it. Because
that's the point.
They're happy to have their investments in what was and is still a fairly high-level return, investing in healthcare.
Mm. Yeah. We have about a quarter of an hour left.
Yeah.
I want to know who you think is promoting civil war in Iraq and whether it would be a good thing, the way Fox News says.
Well, last week you were suggesting that the bomb that took down the Golden Mosque was actually a very deep black advance done by special ops. I don't think you need to go that far. I think that the U.S. policy is designed to cause schism from the get-go.
Exactly.
So,
We had the
whirlwind, I think, right now.
We had both points made by Robert Fisk in a broadcast from Australia last night, and that's Fisk is
where you can find that.
It's on the net. Fisk is the dean of English language correspondence in the Middle East. Well, at least of British correspondence, I suppose. There are plenty of local English language correspondence, but you see what I mean. An important account that makes these two points, that is the U.S. control and the Salvador option, and the way in which civil war may be the goal of American policy in Iraq right now. It will allow the Bush administration to say, well, we tried to bring these people to democracy, but they're just too fractious and too infected with Islam, and we couldn't do it, so we're just going to hold on to our strong positions near the oil and let the rest of the country go to hell in a handbasket. Daniel Pipes, for example, wrote this last week about how civil war in Iraq is a good thing, and it's consistent with the neocon position for a long time of balkanizing the Middle East so that the U.S. Control would never be confronted with any sort of unified opposition, but only the opposition of various statelets scattered around the area where all our oil is oh so uncomfortably under their sand.
It's amazing how some of these guys can say right out loud
Exactly. And the one thing the neocons have to distinguish them is the fact that they've done that all along. Their policy is really not that much different from what the policies are not that much different from what U.S. governments have been doing all along. But as you say, they say it out loud.
Well, there's one thing that gets said about the neocons about how they had this commitment to democracy. If you read their documents, it's not there.
It's not there.
Maximizing U.S.'s power is what
that's
and the
exactly
role in the
right.
world.
That's so, exactly. You
know, but it's attributed all the time and it's without any substance.
You're absolutely right, and one of the best examples was there was a piece in the Sunday New York Times Magazine a week ago by Francis Fukuyama, who was a bread-in-the-bone neocon. He was a man who wrote the book The End of History, an article, and then a book The End of History 15 years ago. He's not stupid, but I mean he announces his departure from the neocon consensus in the New York Times a week ago, and it's all cast in terms about, well, yes, it would have been a good idea to bring democracy to the Middle East, but we really couldn't do it. I mean, it was beyond our reach and so forth, and the neocons have deluded themselves by thinking they could do it. That was, that was the neocon goal only if we understood democracy as a specialized term, meaning comfortable situation for American economic and strategic operations. That's democracy. And so that makes your General Bushara, for example, a perfect example of this democracy. But it has nothing to do with democracy as most people understand the word.
Curious roles by people. The National Archives had Alan Weinstein, who was like the inaugural person for the National Endowment for Democracy, and I remember him when he goes back to being a malefactor in the whole attack on Nicaragua. I'm sure it's the same guy.
It is. But he goes back even further than that. He made his scholarly reputation by trying to prove that Alger Hiss was guilty as charged, and insisted that that it was the case was never in doubt.
Well, he's put upon by those those vigorous librarians to stop cooperating with the reclassification of documents. I wonder how long that'll hold up. It's hard to understand his motives given his history, but it is a good thing that they've stopped reclassifying. This, again, looks like Cheney started it out. It came out of the Department of Energy and then was spread throughout, and the CIA has been using it to cover up anything that looks bad on them. Do we have a fan mail from some flounders?
No. A caller wanted to know about I mentioned the Robert Fisk interview where he talked about the U.S. promoting civil war and the black advances and so forth, and the U.S. responsibility, very likely, for the Samarra mosque bombing. It was a transcript of an interview on Australian television, a thing called Lifeline, I think. Mm. And it appeared on a website. In fact, one place you can get it is on the listserv for the AWARE, the anti-war, anti-racism effort. You can Google them, and they have a discussion list called Peace Discuss. Peace-discuss, and if you want to join the list, why things like this are often posted to it. This particular one, I'm looking right now, I think I can find you a URL or at least tell you how to do it.
The best
Fisk
keyword, probably Fisk Australia, I don't know, would maybe come up, Lifeline.
Go to something called Information Clearinghouse. Put the whole phrase together, informationclearinghouse.info. Google that, and when you come up to their page, they have a list of articles, and if you scroll down far enough, you will find the Fisk interview, that's the best way, that's the fastest way, I think, to find it.
Freedom of information and suppression of documents, et cetera, et cetera. There's a great article by Shane Harris in this National Journal, a magazine that's, I guess, been around for a while, but they're doing some new stuff called TIA Lives On, and you can just Google TIA Lives On. This is the information awareness, total information awareness thing. Has interesting story, and it has connections to a corporation that has a place in the university in the Urbana-Champaign region, which is Scientific Applications in Computing, SAIC. They have their name on one of the buildings on South First Street, and I have a suspicion that might be one of the places where they might be doing that kind of research, which is looking into more of this total information awareness. I've always thought that they've been doing this Operation Stockpile business there, which is computer simulations of nuclear explosions, so you don't have to do the testing because you're doing it virtually. This is to make sure our stockpile is intact and not deteriorating slowly, which would be a strategy, I guess, for us to comply with the NPT if we put off things long enough without checking our see if our powder's dry, maybe this stuff would all just go away. Obviously, I'm joking in a perverse sort of way.
And SAIC, we mentioned this a week or so ago, and I said that I thought that they were involved with the study that the Marines were doing of ethnic minorities in southwest Iran, which I hadn't seen reported in any American publication, but it was reported in the Financial Times in London. And I checked that, and it is indeed SAIC that's doing the investigation for
them. We were talking off the air last week. We didn't get that stuff on the air last week.
That's
why I wanted to
glad we got it
today.
On now. Maybe what we should do is walk around, see what our friends and neighbors here in town are up to, how they spend their day.
I thought a protest over there would be
exactly
apropos, but I've always thought a protest over at Amdocs would be in order, too. Mm-hmm. This is a predominantly Israeli-owned company that does American documents, and they were implicated a while back, and I've never heard seen or any follow-up research since what they do is they do directory assistance, et cetera, et cetera. Apparently, that's a good place to be data mining if you're trying to find out who's talking to who and who's looking to contact who. And there was the allegation a while back that actually came out on Fox, and I haven't seen it anywhere else. But I thought it's a nice little area on Fox Drive. The SAIC is on South First Street.
So. Fox Drive. Is that an accident? In any case, this is a matter of great interest, of course, to the administration. It was quietly announced this week that Iran is investing $1 billion in Iraqi-based businesses. And the Iraq government, which, you know, is supposed to be following orders here. The Iraq government said they were happy to have that. That's good. And maybe they actually will get some reconstruction done now with Iranian money.
Since the U.S.
doesn't put any in their budget.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, they lined it out.
That's right.
Which is astonishing.
That is amazing. And what the U.S. is doing, of course, is trying to get Ibrahim Jafari, who is the front runner for the prime minister's post in Iraq, out of his job. And you know, I know why they're doing it, Paul. You see, Jafari said last week he liked Noam Chomsky's stuff, and he wondered if he could get Chomsky to come to Iraq and talk.
Oh, I have no idea
did.
About
yes,
that.
Yes, he actually did.
Well, he is Kurdish, and he knows that Chomsky's been going to bat for the Kurds.
I think you're confusing him with Talabani. I think
the
president is Talabani. He's Kurdish. You're right. Jafari, this was a discussion where he was listening to, you know, I mean, claims to have read Chomsky's accounts and was listening to him.
Well, I remember when Chavez, Amy Goodman said that he was enjoying Chomsky lately. We suggested this is why he's really dangerous. He's planning a space program. Did you read this about Chavez?
This is amazing.
This has got to do with Telesur, the south-to-south transmission, the idea that the South ought to be telling its own story to itself. It's funded by Venezuela, Uruguay, Argentina, and I forget who else. But apparently they want some of that geosynchronous orbit, some of that satellite arc up there with their own satellites, so they don't have to pay any major corporation. So they plan on launching a communication satellite themselves. And, of course, the U.S. is worried about war in space, and they didn't think they were going to have to be taking on Venezuela, too, apparently.
We've got, we should mention, there's more of that. I mean, these rulers that the U.S. Is having such trouble with, I mean, Jafari is also apparently asked, it's reported in the British press, he's asked for Turkish troops to come into Iraq to do the sort of peacekeeping that the Americans aren't doing. And
That'll really help solidify the coalition.
There you are indeed. Yeah, talk about putting the cat among the pigeons.
There's a speculation that if civil war goes on, that the Turkish will be in northern Iraq like that.
Because of the problem of an independent Kurdistan and the danger and the willingness of the Turks. One of the greatest ethnic cleansings of the Clinton years, of course, occurred in Turkey as the Turks killed thousands of Kurds and wiped out villages U.S. supplied weapons and U.S. support. Precisely.
While we're
right.
sort of in that region, I noticed a favorite of mine. We were citing Chomsky on Kosovo, the book. Lessons from Kosovo.
A New Generation Draws the Line was the first one, and the second one
military,
was humanitarian intervention.
Military humanitarianism, or something of that sort.
Exactly.
The contradiction in terms is the way that he was wanting it to be read. But Akhim Ketu, who you don't read about very much, he's...
Sounds like something out of Star Wars.
He volunteered to go down and help the Croatians kill Serbians in the Krajine region of Kosovo, right. And then came back and was working in Kosovo. And he's very spooky. He's very linked to the CIA, and he's apparently going to possibly be the next prime minister of Kosovo, which, I thought he got in the docket a while back because he was a great candidate for at least showing that there might be some even-handedness in the prosecution of those war crimes from South Slavia.
Well, since Kosovo is essentially being run by the U.S. subcontractor NATO these days, there's how the discussion is.
Well, not completely, because we have Camp Bondsteel there, one of the bases that is even off the books, I guess, according to Johnson.
But it's an American protectorate,
But not NATO. Subcontracted directly. NATO's there, but we also have Camp Bondsteel, which means that we're directly controlling
NATO is our creature. I mean, this is the point and the issue.
I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying we're not just subcontracting.
We have a minute or two left.
We have our own contractor there.
We have a minute or two left, and we've got a question from a listener who wants us to elaborate on SAIC. I thought you had, but you want to say a little more about SAIC?
Well, their board of directors is spooky. It's a lot of ex-CIA people. There was an accusation a while back, speaking of Chavez, that they're in a lot of oil and Halliburton kind of stuff. They do like computer control stuff. That there was an allegation during the so-called oil strike, mainly by managers, that SAIC went in and sabotaged all of the pipeline and refinery distribution software from a distance, that they hacked their own software. They knew where all the back doors was because they sell the stuff. And that's not the most of it, but since they're pretty shady, they're sort of an off-the-shelf operation. And if you spell their name backwards, of course, it it's rather apparent that they don't really care. People know what they're up to.
I was talking about the fact that this marine study is being done by a group called Hicks and Associates, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Science Applications International Corporation (SAIC), which in fact is one of the biggest defense contractors in terms of the number of contracts they have throughout the American government, and they were deeply involved in the pre-war planning, such as it was for Iraq. So I mean, this is they're not newcomers. They're part of a major part of the military-industrial complex in the
U.S. They had the first contract for putting stories in the Iraqi press, and they got out of it. Maybe they knew it was going to be exposed, but then, despite the fact that it's been exposed several times, it hasn't stopped, and Rumsfeld apparently doesn't know about it, because it was this week or last he asserted that indeed the planning of stories had been over, and it wasn't, and now he just says, well, we're studying.
He was misinformed. Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah. There's a number of people are doing odd things this week, Paul, all sorts of things. I loved Saddam Hussein at his trial with his let my people go invocation.
No.
I mean, he said, look, you know, you're charging me for things that that other people do as a matter of course, such as the governor of Texas in terms of signing execution orders, but he says you're also after a lot of other people here, and there's no reason to do that. I was the head of state, and you should not be charging them. Quite a remarkable moment, not played much in the American press. Tell us about why Andrew Young is being the spokesperson for Walmart these days, but there's another interesting exchange.
Well, he's been a bad actor.
Exactly.
I don't think he got invited to the NAACP Awards last night, even though Julian Bond was holding up his part of the show quite well, I thought.
Andrew Young, years ago during the apartheid regime of South Africa, he went to South Africa and said, look, you all have to do what we did in America in the civil rights movement and get this group together and stop talking about all this class stuff, to which the ANC replied, stop talking racism, we have a class war to win here in South Africa.
Yeah.
Amazing exchange. Oh, yeah, sure, of course. One we should have, one I thought you would probably have mentioned, Donna Shalala and, her problems. Donna Shalala was a Clintonoid member, a cabinet
HGW,
member. That's right. And is now president of the University of Miami. And a glossy magazine last week did a wonderful thing about how luxuriously she lives at the University of Miami. Well, she has just scotched an attempt of the janitors at the University of Miami to establish a living wage of the slightest form at that university while she goes on to and here's this thereby hangs a tale too, the politics of Larry Summers was president of Harvard, the politics of his departure, while not necessarily labor based, are involved in a number of the other issues that we've talked about frequently. You've been listening to News from Neptune, Carl Esterbrook and Paul Muth talking about the news of the week and its coverage by the media.